As we do each Tuesday, we welcome in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. His latest book, well, his latest of three, is If You, brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope. Also check out his wonderful book on Sam Cooke, Live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963, and his analysis and thoughts on the 1951 film Scrooge. Hello there, Colin.
Hello, Richard.
How are you on this fine day? You didn't do another 10,000 step day, did you?
I did not. I had a zero step day.
Ooh.
I have not gone out, but been doing my thing and dealing with some stuff. Need to do better tomorrow. Not going to lie, Richard. I feel a bit like I'm Diane Chambers. I call you Richard because when Dick Cavett was on, she's like, Richard. I'm like, oh, yeah, Richard Kimball. Yes, need to do better tomorrow. Much better tomorrow.
Well, if there's anybody who can do that, it's you. So much to discuss today. Let's begin with the music side of things and some wonderful unreleased recordings of the Beatles' Rubber Soul Sessions, one of my favorite albums of all time. It's so fascinating to hear some of this creative process, a lot of it based on them trying to work out the harmonies on Think for Yourself.
Creative process, you should say that with quotes around it, because it's pretty... They're just some guys having a good time, a good high time in the studio, aren't they, on this one, Mr. Kimball? We had talked, I remember once, about the irony of the Grateful Dead and their studio outtakes from the 1970 albums, Workingman's Dead and American Beauty, and how dead serious they were in the studio. Taskmasters all. And the Beatles were like children, and it's romper room, and nap time is over, and you have to get them going in the same direction. This is when cannabis became a big part of the studio sessions. I don't think there's much doubt that certain things that George Martin isn't himself approving of have been passed around covertly at some point, and they're trying to do the backing vocals on George Harrison's Think for Yourself. And there's also, within this comedy of vocal errors and friends trying to crack each other up, there's kind of like this important point that I don't think this would be happening if it was a Lennon and McCartney song. But it's Harrison's song. So Lennon and McCartney are like, yeah, they don't really care as much.
Right. What does Lennon say at one point? You know, I feel pretty useless in these things. I tell Cynthia about it. She understands.
Yes, poor Sin, and she's got some bad stuff coming up in the next year, really. But they had taken over the studio. This is not something you would have heard. It's not like, okay, we've heard the Beatles doing this, and the Animals were doing it, and there's a Who version of it, and Jerry and the Pacemakers. There really wasn't. It became their clubhouse on account of the success that they were having. So, in a way, we can say that the looseness of the session that's clearly in audible evidence presages the total studio takeover of Sgt. Pepper. When, if they're not at home, they're living in that studio and they're coming in for sessions at 10 o'clock at night. It's not how this worked. It was like a business, and you were there at business hours. So we're hearing like a little bit of a dry run for how Pepper's going to unfold. And studio time is expensive. Studio time, for you hockey parents out there, like ice time, it was expensive. So if you are a hockey parent, that's why you and your kid are driving to the rink at like 4:30 in the morning because of the price. But with the Beatles, it was becoming less of an issue, so they can horse around, as we hear here, for 20 minutes.
And I always liked George Harrison. But I have to say, after listening to this, after watching the Peter Jackson documentary, and obviously things are edited a certain way, but I don't, he comes across to me at times as being just a little bit whiny.
Don't be fooled by the George Harrison revisionist history, where in our current age, everything has to be gotten wrong and inverted. George Harrison is perhaps my favorite guitarist, not because he was the best or necessarily all that good, but because he played the lead guitar passages on the Beatles' music. But he was a miserable, miserable, miserable bastard. And I say that as a technical bastard myself. He was boring. He was dour to the point of just sucking the energy out of the room. And that was work to a cinematic advantage in A Hard Day's Night when he has that scene. You know how they all get a scene by themselves.
Right.
Ringo's is all like melancholic and highly effective and hungover and walking around next to this like horrible, like dirty sluice. But Harrison was dour and he was putting down these people who were doing this fashion show and everything. That was like not that far removed from who he was with the comic twist. And then later in life, he would just bore people going on and on about Hinduism and the sitar and things of that nature, and was infamous among the people who knew him for forcing his interest upon them without making any attempt to also get them interested. So it's just something people say now, Richard. Like, everyone says everything they say now. The point's on Twitter, and they use what I call the ass voice. And so George Harrison is a the conception of who George Harrison is a direct result of the ass voice. But to be fair to him, if you were in that position and you're dealing with these two guys and they don't treat you on the same level, but, I mean, really, should they? And you're trying to do, like, your song. Well, you actually had, like, a couple on Rubber Souls. It's going well for you. They're not taking you seriously.
Right.
And, like, that's pretty obvious. So you kind of joke a little to go along, but you're thinking, like, these MFers.
Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. Rich Kimball here in my ass voice. let's talk about a song that you introduced me to. I was not familiar with Jamie T and Alicia Keys. A song that you say may be the best of the century. Tell us why.
I think it's one of the best songs ever written because it is the existential human drama, Richard, turned into a lengthy album concluding cut. This is off of 2007's record Panic Prevention, which I think is one of the best records ever made. And I would go so far as to say that if there were only two songs that I could have written, this would be one of them. I think as a work of hearable literature, it's a masterpiece. It's an existential journey and a kind of crisis of the soul that is resolved via hope and humor and fighting through despair. It sounds like nothing. I was trying to picture what a fellow like yourself would have thought of it the first time you heard this. And I will tell a very stirring story about one time when I was listening to the song. I was in Chicago, and it must have been like not long after the record had come out. I mean, I play this all the time, and I was playing it all the time back then, down in the basement. So it must have been like Christmas, and my sister Kara was there. And she was wrapping presents, and I was listening to this on the computer. And we don't have like a huge amount in common, really, which is also something I can say pretty much about everyone I've ever known. So it's not like a knock or a criticism or anything like that. I was listening to this, and I didn't say anything to her, and it wasn't that particularly loud. And she must have been able to hear it from like the other side of the basement. And she just came walking over. I'm sure she wouldn't even remember it, and sat down next to me. And we listened to it in silence. And it just was this connective moment. And when it was over, we didn't talk about it. And she just kind of went off again. And so it's a song of that nature. And so what did you think of it?
Yeah, at first listen, I'm like, what is this? What has Colin sent me? And then I started picking up on some of the lyrics, and I said, all right, clearly there's more here than I'm picking up on first listen. So I listened to it again, and this time opened up online and read the lyrics and saw what was going on. And it's a pretty powerful treatise on a number of things, and I love, as somebody, we all battle this to a certain extent, but especially if you're creative at all, you battle conformity. And I love that part of it. Musically, it's not something that I would listen to every day, but it's got a great message.
I could listen to it all day. The singing is it's just unlike anything. And I've never even looked at like a lyric sheet for it, because the syllables impart the necessary meaning in the same way that I would advise people to read Joyce's Ulysses in that fashion. I think it's a work of art, easily on that level, but more accessible. And it goes into these different time signatures too, and eventually it becomes a march. And there's sort of like this Laurel and Hardy, the way like Hardy would turn and address the camera, comment where Jamie T sings like between the actual beats. It's like a march in it. Like he's commenting on what's actually happening as he's making it. And then when he gets to the refrain, when it becomes this sort of mantra of what am I, who am I in my own dear eyes? And it becomes highly percussive and rhythmic, and it's an audible pun off of that march time signature. When I hear something like that, I think this is the Bach stuff. This is like the big boy stuff. People don't do this. You go a decade without hearing anyone do anything this sophisticated in music or in art. So I would advise you, not that I'm trying to George Harrison you here, Kim, and get you into like Hinduism, I would advise you not to let this be the end of your life journey with this song. Try it again sometime.
Oh, I will. I've listened to it three and a half times. I will listen to it more as well. But I do want to talk about some art that hit very hard. And that's one of your recent short stories, Da Silva, which just absolutely blew me away. I suspected it would when I read a little preview that you sent out. And my God, it was just phenomenal. Again, as you do so well in a short piece, and I don't know, what was it, 1,600 words, and yet I felt like I knew the people in this story and had known them for years.
Well, it was actually quite a long story, Mr. Kimball. It was like 4,300 words.
Wow.
So this one had...
It didn't feel like it.
Well, I mean, I guess that's the thing, though, with the long ones or the short ones. What's long and what's short when it comes to my work? Do you know what I'm like? Mm. When you have an experience in life, you don't look at it as long or short, do you? It doesn't register that way. It registers as this thing that happened to you, but you don't like hang a time statistic on it. It's this experience that you've had, and there is an awful lot happening in this story, because really what it is it's two stories at once, isn't it?
Oh,
so
yes.
You have like the outer story that you're always conscious of as you go along, and you become increasingly aware at different stages that there's this entire different story within the walls of the outer story that is the real story. So the way it starts is this guy, he's going to be our narrator. And he starts by saying that his neighbor, this guy, is his best friend. But their families, their respective families, are closer than that. That he would say that his neighbor's wife is his wife's best friend and, like, his second best friend. So they're all, like, really great friends with each other. And this neighbor had, tenses are very important in all of my work. Nothing's accidental. Everything is controlled. So if there's a had instead of a has, there's a reason every single time. And then the neighbor had this dog, this beagle, named Thaddeus, Thad for short. And everyone loved Thad. And the narrator was talking about how his boy was run over by a truck and his leg was crushed. And they didn't know if he'd be able to walk again. He was in bed for a long time. And really what got him through it in large part was that this dog, the neighbor's dog, came over and essentially became their dog. For a while. And the father had sort of been lying to himself about how he wasn't drifting apart from his son, but they were. And they end up having all this time together and getting closer than they would have been. And so the boy comes through it and he sort of gets influenced by his own, what he's gone through, stuff of that nature. So we're in the future after this, and we find out that Thad used to have this thing for when it was really cold. He would run out of the yard and he would go to the pond across the street from these two families' houses. And he'd sort of go into the middle of the pond, and that was his thinking spot. But those days were behind him, so everyone thinks, until one day the narrator, he's home alone, his wife's out at the antique mart, watching basketball on the TV, looks out, it's winter, and he sees old Thad out in the middle of the ice. And the ice is giving way. So what's going to happen is this dog, who has meant so much to this family for more reasons we're going to find out about, is going to not just die, but they're going to have to watch him die. So he calls the fire department, calls his friend next door. Fire department shows up, and it's a small town. These guys are all townies. And so there's just one fire truck, town like that. We're probably in Michigan if you do some of like the measurements later with the miles of other things I've referenced. But somewhere in the Middle West, and the fire engine shows up, and this guy from high school gets out, and this would be De Silva. And De Silva is a dick. He would take your girl in high school. He wouldn't just take your girl. He'd do like unspeakable things with your girl, and she'd never be your girl again. And he hasn't grown up at all, and they're in their 50s, these guys. And De Silva is going to do something completely mind-blowingly shocking and out of character, they think.
Yeah, and what I love is that he does that thing that's out of character, but still is very much the De Silva that they have all despised for 40 years.
Yes, and the narrator says something along the lines of, after he did this, I didn't begrudge him being that. So things work out a certain way. And then we're later, I mean, this is just like full throttle, run you over emotionally with pain and sadness, but also beauty and hope and happiness and warmth. There's just so much happening. The narrator and his buddy are in the buddy's garage, and they're working on a 1947 Indian motorcycle. It's not me being racist. That's the name of the motorcycle. And they start having this conversation about De Silva. And we've known that the narrator's friend has hated De Silva like even more than the narrator. And so finally it's like, well, what is it with this guy? And so the friend sort of says something about why he has this special rancor for him. But we're also talking about the fleeting nature of goodness or the difficulty in understanding. We're so quick to label good person, good action, bad action, that type of thing. Sometimes it's vantage point. Sometimes it's situation. Sometimes it's opportunity, because we're so flawed. So it's rarely like 100% all the way through. And there are these voices coming from inside. So the guy's wife is back from the antique mart, and she's in there. And we find out that his grandchildren are in there, and his daughter-in-law. And we find out, well, I mean, publishing is making it so people can't see this right now, but I can't give this away because it'll just mean too much to people when they do.
Right.
See, we find out something that the story has built to, and it doesn't become a twist, because we've been, in a way, prepared for it all along. And then we have this epiphany after we're done reading. If the dog hadn't existed, well, you know what that means. And that is just, like, lay you out stuff. And it's so gutting, but we still want it to be that way.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking, and it's uplifting at the same time, and it's such a great essay on friendship, the bonds that get stretched sometimes in family, but ultimately come back, and then how little things, how moments in lives can keep having impact for years and years and years, and it just weaves it all together in this wonderfully powerful, but richly funny story. It's just, I've read it three times, and it gets better each time.
Yeah, that's something that I've noticed, that when I see the occasional piece by someone in publishing that's not horrible, I read it through and I work out what they're doing. And I sort of see the techniques they're using, and I think, oh, okay, this is better than the other things I normally read. When I read it again, I don't get more out of it. Do you see what I mean? I get less out of it because I've already figured out like there are two or three little techniques. And that's what's making it work insofar as it works. It's not working with the rich guts of life. When you are looking at someone and they're alive and they die in front of you, and things have changed within 2 seconds, less than that, there's nothing you can do to put the life back in the body. It'll still feel a certain way for a few seconds, whatever. But once the life is gone, it's gone. And there's so little out there in art or would-be art that has the life. And you can't fake the life. And the life is more than just how the words come together, although that's a part of it. There's so many different parts of it. You can't fake the life. And when you experience life and you revisit the moment or the story in this case, it always has more to give you than the time before. But that's the point. That's why it's art. That's why it'll be around in however many years.
Well, when people get to read this, it's going to take you for a ride. And if you're a dog person on top of that, like I am.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Just a puddle over in the corner.
Well, that's the thing, because it looks like it's a dog story at first.
Yeah.
And if you are a dog person, it is the ultimate dog story. I mean, the Thad is like the breakout star of the story. And you could have a discussion in the classroom for an hour. Why is it titled De Silva? And I think like high school students would have brilliant comments on that, contrasting comments and everything. But ultimately, beyond the dog, beyond everything, it's a story about a father and a son.
Yeah. Well, it's wonderful. De Silva by Colin Fleming. Before we wrap it up this afternoon, let's shift and talk some baseball and a wonderful sidetrack to the career of a Hall of Famer. That moment in 1945, or that, well, nine appearances, when the great Jimmy Fox, XX, decided to become a pitcher.
Jimmy Fox had a strange end to his career. He had a strange end to his life. Do you remember how he died?
Didn't he choke to death?
He did.
Yeah.
So you might well ask, in these times, why was there no Heimlich maneuver? Well, it hadn't been invented yet, I don't think.
No, it hadn't.
And it didn't occur to anyone. And he was such a big guy, too. I wonder if that would have made it harder. But he was on our Boston Red Sox in the early 40s. So his teammate with Ted Williams. And he lost his power pretty quickly. I think it was his last full season with the Red Sox, he had over 100 RBI. But he had 19 home runs, which was strange for Jimmy Fox. And he becomes this journeyman. In a way, I think he had money problems, and he was trying to hang on during the war years. And then he was really trying to hang on when he was done as a regular position player as this 11th hour pitcher. It was just on a horrible team. And he's I'll be a pitcher. His ERA was 1.5 or something. He was dominant. But normally you'll see a guy like a Jimmy Fox. Ted Williams, he had an outing as a pitcher. Jose
That's
Canseco
right.
did. This sometimes is go out there. And you get to fulfill your childhood fantasy when you're getting crushed 23-7. Never when you're winning. It's always when you're losing, because that would be disrespectful. But Jimmy Fox made this concerted effort. I don't really know of any modern, I think we'd have to go back to the days of Icebox, our man Icebox in the 1800s to find someone. It would be Harmon Killebrew coming out of the bullpen and dropping curves on you.
Right. And again, it wasn't just a one-off. It was nine appearances. Control was a bit of an issue. He had 14 walks in 22 innings.
He started two games. But seriously, wasn't his ERA 1.53?
Yeah.
I don't have it in front of me.
Yeah, 1.59 earned run average.
So he was, which it's when people make the argument about, people could be so much more effective in their arguments if they actually knew things. So one argument I would make if I was trying to say that it was much easier for certain athletes to be dominant back then was I would point to Jimmy Fox being who's the guy the Red Sox had in 2013? Uehara, who was the best reliever I've ever seen. That's who he was for a while.
Mm.
Jimmy Fox, he was Hoyt Wilhelm, starting some games, relieving other games. And true, this was the war years. So it was 1945. And so it was a depleted major league. And that was true with all the sports, for a long time. I mean, it didn't have an asterisk, but Maurice Rocket Richard with the 50 goals in 50 games.
Right.
Everyone would be but he did it during the war years, as if he was playing against the Little Sisters of the Poor. But it didn't keep, the experiment did not last. That was the end for Fox. He did not come back. And I haven't checked, but it would be interesting. I think it's unlikely. But imagine if his actual last appearance on a baseball field was as a pitcher and not as a hitter or a positional player.
Yeah, that would be phenomenal. And then you mentioned his post-baseball career. Boy, he drifted in and out. He did some managing in the All-American Girls League, went on to become head coach of the University of Miami, was a hitting coach at AAA for a while, and owned businesses, but lost all his money again and struggled with that his whole life. Apparently, he could hit like nobody's business, but not very good with the money.
No, and you had less of a margin for error with the money at the time. And he was one of those guys. He's become underrated. You can't quite squeeze him into the top 10 of all time, if we're just talking hitters, but he's at 12 or 13. He's somewhere around there. I think Ted Williams had him in his personal top 10. Obviously, there have been a lot of years since then, but he was just phenomenal as a hitter. And he was one of those people, too, where weightlifting wasn't the thing you did back then, certainly in baseball. Because remember when weightlifting became the vogue, like in the 70s, like it was kind of controversial. And then Carlton Fisk was weightlifting in like 1985. And Lance Parrish was really, catchers, was one of the first people to be like pro weightlifting because people thought it made you too muscle bound and messed up your swing. So I have never understood how people like Lou Gehrig and Jimmy Fox, like type in Jimmy Fox, like shirtless on Google. How do you get to be that big unless you're weightlifting 7 hours and cut every day? Like, I don't understand that. I mean, it doesn't happen to me except in the legs when I'm going up and down the stairs. I don't come home. I'm like, yeah, biceps, baby.
When he retired, I'd forgotten this. I think I learned it as a kid. When he retired from the game, he was number two on the all-time home run list behind Babe Ruth.
It's funny how context changes for us because, like, Gil Hodges recently finally made it into the Hall of Fame. And I don't know that he should be in there. I'm glad that he is because it's cool. I liked him. But when he retired, you can sort of do that, like that prefatory remark. But when he retired, he was whatever crazy sort of mind-boggling, like third or fourth all-time in home runs, like RBI. And then the years passed, and like all of these guys that like you don't really think of as like superstars accumulate more. But it's always interesting to go back and note where someone was when they were done, because I think it gives us a greater appreciation of how outstanding they were. And that can be lost in time, how outstanding people were. And Jimmy Fox was a pretty good athlete. Obviously, you're a good athlete. I don't care who you are or what era it is. If you just show up on the mound, pick up the rosin bag, and have a 1.59 ERA.
Yeah, go to Baseball Reference and check out Jimmy Fox's career. Some pretty impressive numbers and interesting numbers, too. Colin Fleming joins us every Tuesday on Downtown. Colin, thanks as always. We will visit again with you next week.
All right, sounds good.